Good evening, everyone. My name is Steve Nissen, and I'm the Senior Director of Employment and Community Programs at the National Capital Chapter of the National MS Society in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us on today's Employment Telelearning Program, Managing Cognitive Symptoms and Fatigue in the Workplace. We know that cognitive symptoms and fatigue are some of the most challenging symptoms to manage in the workplace. We also know that difficulty managing these symptoms oftentimes lead people with MS to leave work prematurely. Our speakers this evening are going to discuss how these symptoms may impact people who are living with MS. But even more importantly, they will share what can be done to help manage these symptoms. Practical things that can make a big impact in assisting you to be productive and to be efficient on the job. We have been hearing that there's been some confusion with the web link that you may have been sent for tonight's call, so did want to let you know that you can still participate in the online portion by going to readytalk.com, that's R-E-A-D-Y, talk, T-A-L-K.com. Provide the access code of 698-6167 and join as a participant. Again, that's readytalk.com. The access code is 698-6167. So you are still able to join us into the online portion of the program tonight. Following our formal presentation this evening, we will be able to open the phone lines for Q&A. You can also submit your questions via the chat function. Also, as a reminder, today's presentation is being taped and will be available on our website shortly. And so to get this evening's program started, I want to introduce our two presenters. Dr. Cynthia Sullivan is a neuropsychologist partner and director of training at the Neuropsychology Associates of Fairfax in Fairfax, Virginia. She is also an assistant professor of neurology at the Georgetown University Medical Center. Throughout Dr. Sullivan's career, she's been actively involved in neuropsychology research with a primary focus on multiple sclerosis. And her research has been presented at national and then also at international scientific conferences. Our second speaker this evening that you'll hear from is Tracy Carrasco. Tracy is an occupational therapist with the MS Comprehensive Care Center of Central Florida in Orlando, Florida, which has become a partner in MS care with the National MS Society. She has been an occupational therapist for 20 years, and became an MS certified specialist in 2008. Dr. Sullivan, I turn the floor over to you.
Thank you, Steve. It's my pleasure to be here tonight. For those of you who have not heard about neuropsychology or aren't familiar with it, I wanted to go over a brief description. Neuropsychology is the study of brain-behavior relationships. It's a specialty within psychology that studies the relationship between the brain and our behaviors. More specifically, we're interested in cognition. Cognition is basically referring to our thinking abilities. And we're interested in cognition and the many factors that can affect cognitive functioning. So the next slide breaks down the various components of neuropsychological functioning. In blue on the right-hand side, you'll see some of the cognitive domains, our thinking abilities, such as language, memory, attention, executive function, which refers to the higher-level thinking skills like reasoning and problem-solving, and then the visual-spatial abilities refers to our ability to understand visual information, so to be able to read a map or a flowchart like this picture here. On the left-hand side in orange are the psychological aspects of neuropsychology, personality, mood, behavior, quality of life, our social functioning, all of that comes together to make up our neuropsychological functioning, and that's what neuropsychologists will study. The next slide goes over what happens in multiple sclerosis, and I want to emphasize something very important here. This is what happens to the brain when multiple sclerosis is not treated. This is based on research from a while back when patients didn't have the medications that are out there today, and this is what we saw, the natural course of the disease. So at the top, you can see different slices of the brain. The first one is a healthy control, and then we have relapsing remitting MS, a couple of those at different stages of the disease, and then a secondary progressive at the end. The spaces in the middle of the brain there are ventricles, and they enlarge with progression of the disease. And so with that enlargement, the brain itself gets smaller, and we call that atrophy. So you can see below that there's a dotted red line going downward, and that is the brain volume decreasing over time. The little arrows at the bottom of the picture are showing the actual MRI activity, so lesions that can be seen on an MRI. And with that, with the more lesions accumulating, we'll have this dotted line going up showing the burden of the disease. And then above that, the relapses and remissions that can be seen and observed and experienced by the patients. So that's untreated MS. And for a long time, physicians believed that MS affected only motor function. It was not thought to be a disorder that had any impact on cognition. However, in the last several decades, we've come to learn that there are cognitive effects of MS. So on the next slide, I wanted to highlight some of Dr. Rao's work. Dr. Rao is a neuropsychologist who was one of the pioneers in studying the cognitive functions in people with MS. And he found that about 43 to 65% of people with MS will have some type of cognitive difficulties, and that those difficulties can contribute to unemployment, accidents, difficulty functioning in daily life, and even some social withdrawal. The pattern and degree of cognitive difficulties is variable. So from one patient to the next, there could be different cognitive difficulties or different severities of cognitive dysfunction. Dr. Rao, on the next slide, this is also based on his research, found that in MS patients who do not have cognitive difficulties, only 16% of that group was unemployed. However, 44% of a group of multiple sclerosis patients with cognitive difficulties was unemployed. So that tells us that it's the cognitive difficulties that are keeping people out of work more so than the physical disabilities. So cognitive dysfunction plays a large role in unemployment and also in difficulty managing activities of daily living. It can contribute to social withdrawal because people become embarrassed about not being able to remember somebody's name or not remembering an important part of a conversation they had with someone before. And it can also lead to psychopathology. That's a scary word, but what it really means is just things like depression and anxiety, which we know there's a slightly increased risk of in multiple sclerosis. So on the next slide, there's a quote from Dr. Amato, who's another researcher in multiple sclerosis in Italy. She's done extensive work on studying the disease. And she says here that limitations in a patient's work and social activities are correlated with the extent of cognitive decline independent of degree of physical disability. So again, kind of highlighting this idea that cognitive decline plays a large role in a person's ability to work, even more so than physical disability. So there are several different ways that MS can affect cognition. I said before that the pattern and degree of involvement is different from one person to the next, but there are some general areas that tend to be affected by MS. Attention, learning and memory, and information processing speed. Those are the three top cognitive domains that tend to be affected in some way in people who have cognitive difficulties with MS. So attention can refer to your ability to stay focused. That could be over a short period of time or a longer period of time. It also refers to your ability to manipulate information in your head. So if you're listening to information in a conversation like this, it's your ability to remember what I just said just a minute or two ago. It's what your brain is working on at the time. We call it working memory, but it's really more related to your attention, your focus. Learning and memory, I'm going to talk about in just a second because that's a very significant concern for a lot of people. Information processing speed is just what it sounds like. It's how quickly you process information, and that can be affected in multiple sclerosis. To a lesser extent, but still affected for some people, is visual spatial perception, like I said before, understanding visual information, and executive function, the reasoning and the problem-solving skills. The domains that tend not to be affected are language and verbal skills. Now, that doesn't mean that people with MS don't sometimes have trouble coming up with words, because that can happen, a word-finding difficulty at times. But the basic understanding of language and your ability to express your thoughts generally remains intact. So on the next slide, we break down the components of memory. In order to remember something, you first have to learn it. And that's the encoding part, getting the information in. Sometimes people with MS will have trouble learning new information, usually with repeated exposure or repeated review of the material, you can learn new information. It just might take you a little longer than someone without MS, or it might be you might not learn quite as much at one time. We test this in our office by reading patients a list of words or a short story, and then we read it several times and ask the person each time to say back as much of it as they can, and we get a sense of how much they're learning with each presentation. And then we come back about a half an hour later and we ask the person to recall as many of the words as they can or as much of the story as they can. And that's the retrieval part. So we're testing here your ability to pull up the information when we ask you to. And that can be difficult at times for people with MS as well. However, we then test your ability to recognize the information. So we'll just say a word or detail from the story and ask you if you remember hearing that before. And if you remember it, if you can recognize it, then we know that you stored the information initially. And that's very important because people with MS do not tend to have any trouble with actual storage. If you were focused on the information as it was coming in and you were able to process it, then most people with MS can store it. They might have trouble pulling it up later on their own, but if they're provided some cues, some helpful hints, then the information is more easily retrieved. And there's a big difference there between multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's. So sometimes I'll have MS patients in my office who say, I feel like I have dementia because I just can't pull up information when I need it. But the truth is it's not at all like dementia. The storage is actually intact. It's just the pulling the information out sometimes it can be hard. But, having some notes available to you or having somebody there who can provide you some helpful hints can be very helpful, whereas that would not be as helpful with somebody with Alzheimer's who just isn't able to store it at all. So on to the next slide, then. I wanted to talk about the ways that you might notice cognitive difficulties presenting themselves at work. So, we have a lot of people on the call tonight and a lot of different jobs, but these are just some examples, and you can kind of think about your job and how this might impact you. If you have difficulty with your processing speed, if you are a little slower to process information, then you might have trouble keeping up with information that's being presented to you. So that might be in a business meeting, somebody's presenting information, you might feel like you're a little bit behind. You're not keeping up with what's being presented. You kind of feel like you're behind the eight ball all the time. Or in a conversation, same thing. You feel like the person is just presenting the information too quickly or it's too much information at once. It can be difficult to keep up. You might have trouble recalling information. So even if you had been able to process it well and focus on it, you just don't remember it later. You can't pull it up when you need to. So that could be something that was presented in a meeting or something someone told you. Or you thought of some things this morning that you wanted to get done today, and then this afternoon you couldn't remember what those things were. Or you forget something that you've read. You don't remember the details as well as you used to. You might have more trouble remembering people's names, which in some jobs maybe that doesn't matter so much. In other jobs, it matters a lot. I have a lot of people in my office who are salespeople, and they complain that it's hugely detrimental when they can't pull up somebody's name. You might forget where you've put things, misplacing things. I mean, we all do that to some extent, but this might be happening more often to you, and it might really hinder your functioning in daily life if you're spending half your time, running around your office trying to find things that you need. You might have trouble with your focus. I talked about attention before. So you might find that your mind is wandering more than it used to. On the next slide, I have a few more. you might be more easily distracted. It's harder for you to filter out extraneous noise. You might lose your train of thought. That could happen in a conversation. You can't remember what you were saying. You got off on a tangent, and now you've lost your train of thought. Or it could happen while you're working on a particular project and you've suddenly lost your train. You don't remember where exactly you were and where you had meant to go next. You might have trouble multitasking, and this is a real problem for a lot of people at work because more and more jobs are requiring their workers to multitask. They want you working on multiple projects at the same time. They want you to be able to handle multiple interruptions, you know, take that phone call, answer the door while you're working on a particular project, switch over to something else, come back to what you're working on, and so on. And that can be more difficult. For most of us, as we age, it gets more difficult, but it can be more difficult even than normal for people with multiple sclerosis. Another problem associated with that is that when you are interrupted, it's harder to come back to what you were doing. You might have trouble pulling up words. So not names now, but just words in conversation. There's a particular word you want to use, and it's just not coming to you. And then an example of something, an executive functioning problem would be you get stuck in your thinking. You're having more trouble thinking outside the box, being creative in your thinking, being more flexible in your thinking. And as I had said before, that's not as commonly affected in people with MS, but a certain subset of MS patients will complain, or those around them will notice that they're a little more rigid in their thinking. Okay, go ahead on to the next slide, Steve. There are several things, multiple things, that can make cognitive functioning even worse. So everyone has to worry about these things. But when you have MS, it's kind of it can be, you know, a cumulative effect of these things on top of any effects that the disease itself is having on cognition or your thinking abilities. Stress is likely to make things worse. Anxiety, depression, any kind of psychiatric distress. Fatigue, which is why, you know, Tracy's going to be talking extensively about fatigue. That has a huge impact on cognitive functioning. When you're tired, you're slower, you're less attentive. Sedating medications for the same reason. Pain can be very distracting. It's hard to focus when you're in pain. Alcohol and drug abuse, that's a no-brainer. Anything that damages or adversely affects your brain health, of course, is going to have a bad effect on your cognitive functioning as well. And that can be at the time or later down the road. So there are some things that you can do to minimize cognitive decline, and this is important. It's important for everyone as we get older, because there is a normal amount of cognitive decline with age. I'm sure everyone can relate to that. But there are also, these are things that you can do to minimize that decline. And when you have MS, these things can be even more important. Eating healthfully is important. You know, people ask me all the time, what should I be eating? I don't have specific foods to recommend here, but just in general, eating healthful foods, you know, our fruits and vegetables and so on. Exercise is hugely important. I've seen numerous very well-controlled studies out there about exercise reducing the risk of cognitive decline. It's kind of the wonder drug these days. This doesn't have to be a rigorous exercise program. It can be very minimal, just going for a gentle walk. I had a woman today in my office who has bad knees, but she can get in a pool and just do some stretching. So something that just keeps the blood circulating. Minimizing stress, this is a tough one. But as much as you can, obviously we can't control everything in our environment, but as much as you can, try to keep the stress levels down. If there are things in your life that you can't control that are very stressful, maybe that would be a good time to talk to somebody about that stress, whether it's a friend or a counselor, a pastor, or a psychologist, psychiatrist, about ways to cope with that stress, just to get through that particularly stressful period. Getting enough sleep is extremely important. Again, this plays into the fatigue, but even without fatigue, there's just general sleepiness that can happen if you're not sleeping well enough. You might need to get a sleep study done. Maybe there's a sleep apnea issue there. We're learning more and more about the negative effects of lack of sleep on cognitive functioning and health in general. Staying mentally and socially active is really important, especially as we get older. Challenging yourself cognitively, staying socially active, and, of course, avoiding the substance abuse. There are some medications out there that can help with cognitive function, depending on the reason for your cognitive difficulties. For MS-related cognitive difficulties, then you need to be on an MS treatment. The disease-modifying agents, there's more and more research about how they can help with cognitive functions because they are actually minimizing that atrophy and lesion load and so on. So the more they can do to kind of stop the disease in its tracks, the better you're going to be functioning cognitively. So first and foremost, with MS, find a disease-modifying therapy that works. And then if you're still having some cognitive difficulties, you can try a psychostimulant medication like Ritalin or Provigil or Nuvigil, something. If your problem is attention and fatigue, then you might want to try those medications. If you're having more trouble with memory, some patients have found some benefit with medications like Aricept, Razadine, Exelon. They're developed for people with Alzheimer's, but they've been used in people with MS with memory problems. The research is, you know, maybe a slight benefit, not a huge benefit. Antidepressants, if your cognitive problems are because you are depressed, which can certainly happen, then an antidepressant can be very helpful. And there are some herbal remedies out there. Talk to your doctors about them. Just make sure your doctors know what you're taking because some can have some bad interaction effects. But in most cases, they can be helpful. Cognitive rehabilitation is another place to turn if you're having cognitive difficulties and you want to work with a professional. This is like physical therapy for the brain. So you work with an individual trained in cognitive rehab or cognitive retraining, and they teach you how to improve your attention, how to improve your memory or your processing speed. And I just listed some studies here that have shown some positive effects of cognitive therapy. And on the next slide, I wanted to talk a little bit about how to compensate for cognitive difficulties. So I've talked about, you know, things you can do to treat them, but now, you know, if you're still struggling cognitively, here are just some basic everyday strategies you can use at work to try to improve your performance. Write things down more if you're having memory problems. This is a good habit to get into because the act of writing will actually help you encode the information initially, and then you have the added benefit of having it written down so you can refer back to it later. Repeatedly review information. We call that rehearsing. So you just want to say it over and over to yourself, or if you've written it down, read it over to yourself to kind of help it sink in. Don't be afraid to use the electronic reminders, all the different things that are out there to help you, the pill boxes, the alarms on your phone, whatever you need to help cue you that you need to be doing something or that it's time to go somewhere or whatever. Focus on only one thing at a time. This is something I recommend for most people in general anyway. Multitasking is great, but we tend to be a little less effective, and the quality of our work is not always as good if we're trying to do several things at once. So if you can focus on one thing at a time and then take the breaks as you need to, if you're starting to feel mentally fatigued, you want to take the break and come back to it again later. Allow yourself enough time. If processing speed is an issue for you, you don't want to put yourself in situations where you're under a time pressure. You can ask other people to slow down when they're presenting information to you, you know, when that's possible. You can ask for information in writing. So you can tell your coworkers to send it to you in an email, or give you a moment to write down a note for yourself while they're asking you to do something. Just get it down in writing. One of the big questions that comes up with my MS patients who are working and they're struggling on the job is, do I want to tell my boss that I have MS and I'm struggling? Because if I do that, I can get some accommodations at work potentially. Or is it better if I don't tell them and just try to do everything I can to improve my cognitive functioning and just do the best I can? So there's no right answer here. This is a very personal decision that's based on, you know, your own difficulties, how you're functioning at work, how much support you have at work, how understanding your employers might be. And, you know, you have to take into account all these different factors when making this decision. But I can tell you that if you decide to talk to your employers, that you should know that you're eligible for accommodations. You know, for a long time, people just thought of that in terms of, well, I need wheelchair access, or, you know, I should be able to get into the building. But there are actually accommodations for cognitive difficulties. So you can have access to a quiet room to work instead of being put in a cubicle that's close to the Xerox machine. So you can also be given extended time for certain projects or flexible hours, or maybe your company could help you work from home a couple days a week. You know, it's all dependent on the type of job you do, and this is where you have to be creative too and think about what could be helpful and then talk to your employer about whether that's an option or not. And then the con, I mean, the thing that keeps people from telling their employers is sometimes that they don't want to share information about their diagnosis. They don't want people to even know that they have MS, and they don't want to be talking about their cognitive difficulties. So again, that's a personal choice, but there are benefits and to either decision. So I just wanted to wrap this up now, give Tracy some time to talk, but just so you go away, these take-home points, basically cognitive difficulties are very common in people with MS. They can adversely affect performance on the job. You might have some difficulty working, but there are things that you can do to maximize your cognitive functioning, minimize the risk of decline. There are disease-modifying agents that can help. And there are symptomatic treatments like Provigil and herbal remedies as well. And then the cognitive rehab, you can pull in, and compensatory strategies. And just remember always that you can be eligible for accommodations at work. And if you're really stuck between a rock and a hard place and you're thinking you're going to lose your job, then I would certainly encourage you to pursue getting some accommodations before you reach that point of giving up. And thank you all for listening. I'm going to turn the mic over now to Tracy.
Great. Thank you. After listening to that program, you're going to see a lot of similarities that come up during this fatigue program, again, geared towards managing fatigue in the workplace. So first off, I'm going to start with what the definition of fatigue is. And it's said to be a subjective lack of physical and or mental energy that is perceived by the individual or caregiver to interfere with usual or desired activities. So I think the important point there to take away is that subjective. Not everybody can see it. Not everybody can say, oh, you have this. It's not like having a broken leg or a rash that someone can see. It's very subjective to you. So facts about fatigue and MS. It's reported up to 90% of individuals with MS have fatigue or reported fatigue. And in that group, more than 50% will report that it is one of the most disabling symptoms for them. There is a really high correlation between depression and cognition along with the fatigue, and it was already mentioned. So, again, a big strong point there. Referred to as an invisible symptom, just like cognition, people don't always understand or know what you're complaining of. And most common cause of disability for patients. So what kinds of types of fatigue we have? To understand fatigue in MS, you have to understand that there are the primary source is that MS lassitude, that probably is due to the impaired conduction of the nerve impulses in the central nervous system. And then there's all those secondary sources. Sleep deprivation was already mentioned. Insomnia, spasticity, or restless leg syndrome can occur for people, and that can actually be part of the sleep disturbance. Medications given to control symptoms can also cause other side effects of being more sleepy. Deconditioning. This is a big one here in our therapy department, because if you're deconditioned and you're fatigued, you don't feel like doing anything, your regular activities or even working out at the gym, and then it just becomes a vicious cycle. The deconditioning and the fatigue continue. Extra exertion for activities, and that can be anything from maybe mobility issues that are having you do a little bit more to get into the shower, or get up and do your routine in the morning before you go to work, or maybe typing at work takes you a little more effort because your coordination is not quite what it used to be. Urinary problems, and that can be frequency is what I was thinking of this, and getting up and having to leave your desk or leave your office space multiple times through the day, and that can be extra tiring. Obesity also, carrying extra weight can be heavy on your bones, cause you to use more energy. depression, which was already mentioned. When you're depressed, you don't really feel like doing a whole lot, and it makes you more fatigued. Noxious stimuli, I mentioned here, kind of like with the urinary problems, we frequently will have patients with urinary tract infections, which can increase your symptoms. So that can be anything from a cold, a flu, even an ingrown toenail. We had a patient who wasn't even aware of the infection, and all her symptoms, with most obviously fatigue, had increased significantly. And then there's temperature sensitivity, which is more heat-related. Next slide. Okay. I have several pharmaceutical agents listed here that work with fatigue, and although I'm not a prescriber, I would say that a lot of my patients come in, and I ask them about their medications, if they've tried any, and they typically will say, well, I tried it once, and it didn't do anything for me. And I think what I want to present is this has to be a dialogue with your neurologist, and that these drugs really aren't a one-size-fits-all. And it could even be something as simple as taking them before bedtime or taking them after bedtime, taking them certain times of day just to give you more energy. Next slide. Okay, so when a patient comes into our clinic and we're talking about fatigue, we want to assess the fatigue first. And this really comes from a lot of interview questioning that I may give them. And what we look at first is, what's a typical day? So looking specifically at their work day, I have them track their activities. And that helps them kind of find out what are their typical habits, what are their typical things that they have to do, and maybe even be able to find out what the problem areas are. Beyond that, I ask them if they'll plan a day in advance. So this means before you go to bed the night before work, you're going to plan what you think activities that you have to do, what are the important things you have to do, and then as the day goes on, go ahead and see how did your day really happen. So were there lots of changes that had to occur? Do you find perhaps that you get very distracted during the day from other people coming in and asking questions, and that changed it up? Or maybe you have so many bathroom breaks you got behind in projects you were supposed to do. The other information that it can give you is, you know, letting you know what days of the week might be more fatiguing. Some people can start Monday morning and be exhausted from maybe having a busy weekend, and then other people will be, you know, Thursday afternoon, they're done. So that gives us some information. What kind of activities or tasks at work are being the most energy consuming? And then what time of day? Mostly afternoons for our patients, but you can figure out and be able to track this a little bit. Next slide. This is just an example of a daily planner. There are plenty that you can pull up off of the internet for free to let you try their products. You can make your own. I have made my own spreadsheet for my patients as well, where they may identify what the priority items are, what your work day is going to look like. And I usually have them on mine include when they wake up in the morning, all the way through their morning routine, all the way to their commute at home. And then again, there's a column to the right where they check off what activities were really completed, and if it wasn't completed, why, what happened. So it's kind of an analysis of your day. Next slide. So now we understand our problems, we're going to understand our fatigue. Write down some ideas on how your fatigue feels to you, being able to give it a rating so that you can identify, well, I know I was really fatigued today, but what part of the day was just the absolute worst for you? When you woke up, were you a little tired? But by the end of the day, that rating scale went way up. It'll help you, too, to be able to identify what precipitates that fatigue so that you can prevent it, and then what kinds of things can relieve that fatigue. Perhaps it's being overheated, so wearing a cooling vest can help relieve the fatigue. And are there other symptoms that may occur with the fatigue? So big ones that I get are increased spasticity, decreased mobility, and then oftentimes blurred vision, especially at the end of the day when working at a computer. And another thing that we can learn is how long that fatigue lasts. Next slide. These are just some examples of how you can track your energy and better understand what your fatigue is. The one on the left is just an example that I pulled off the internet. You can have a little piece of paper at your desk. You can check off how you're feeling and get a little more information there. The one on the right is an application for a phone, which since most people now have smartphones available or tablets available, you can easily just type in, plug in how you're feeling, rate it, and then it can also help you track other symptoms that may be involved. If you're moderately fatigued, wow, that sometimes precipitates a headache, or you're feeling irritated, or brain fog occurs. Next slide. So now that we've got this information, I took this approach from a book I read from Nancy Lohnstein, who is also an occupational therapist, and she helped to break down what do we do next. So we're going to look at how we are working, what changes need to occur to ourselves. Do we need to change the activities, or do we need to change that actual environmental layout? Next slide. So changing yourself, you're a little Energizer Bunny over there. I think that the top one there is kind of close to my heart, light to moderate exercise. I work in a clinic with OTPT and speech, and we're always talking about getting active and getting energy. And about 20 years ago, they pretty much said, well, you know, you're really fatigued. If you exercise, it's just going to make it worse, which is really not the case. And so now we get our patients to do exercise to their level, not passing themselves into that horrible fatigue level that they get. And the most recent research is saying about 5 days a week, light to moderate exercise for about 30 minutes. But the good part is you can split that 30 minutes up into 10-minute shifts. So it might even be something like, well, I took the stairs up in the morning, and then I did some stretching and a little bit of exercising at my desk, and I walked around. So then you've already got some exercise under your belt while you're at work. The next one is good nutrition. I think that was already touched on as well. If you put good stuff into your body, you're going to have a lot better results, and you're going to feel better, so you'll have more energy. Sleeping habits, I'll go into a little more detail in a minute. Stress management, which was also mentioned in the earlier program, crucial. I do this with quite a bit of my patients. It may even just be involving improving your breathing, meditating, positioning to help you relax. The more energy that you spend on being anxious and stressed and worried, the more energy is now gone out of your pot for that day. So you're having to spend money or spend energy that you don't want to spend. You'd rather spend it doing something you enjoy. Rest breaks and visual breaks are important as well throughout your day. I'll go into those in a second. Delegating tasks to others, and I put this under changing yourself because what I found is so many times people just don't want to give up their independence, or they feel like maybe they're failing if they have somebody else do a task that they're typically doing. But if you can save energy and be more productive in other ways, you really should think about that. And that can be just tasks at home, like having the kids make their lunches or having a family member help you with the pet care in the morning, or it can be something at work that somebody can help you that may not be a big deal for them but really drains energy for you. Sitting posture and standing posture are crucial. We use way more muscles and muscle energy by leaning over or leaning back. So if you're having difficulty with that, a physical therapist would be wonderful to help you get your sitting, proper sitting balance. And also keeping your muscles stretched. Even if you're going to be sitting for long periods of time, you need to change your positions often, and stretch breaks are great with that. And they also help with spasticity management, which is very fatiguing in itself. Next slide. Okay. So I have a picture over there on the left of a man with perfect posture, nice straight line down his body. And you see the man that's leaning towards the front. if you actually do this little experiment, you're going to see how much more energy you have to use to actually lean forward. You're having to use back muscles and stomach and thigh muscles that if you were to just stand up tall, you have a better center of gravity and you don't have to expend that extra energy. The one on the right is a computer or a desk stretch task. You do them in sequence. It's very popular. You can find it on the internet, anywhere else, or anywhere for free. And it's a nice one to have maybe posted at your desk as a little reminder of being able to do some stretching. Also, only once an hour or when you're really feeling stiff, that would be beneficial. Next slide. So now I've got a picture of the perfect workstation, perfect ergonomic workstation. And what you're seeing is some nice back support, hips and knees at 90 degrees, and the computer screen directly across from your gaze so that you're not having to bend your neck forward or backward. What might be important to think about is, depending on what business you work for, your human resources department may have available an ergonomic evaluation, and that's where somebody would come out to your desk and be able to look at it and see, you know, what kinds of changes do we need to hire the keyboard, lower the chair, give you more back support. And a lot of times they'd love to pay for that rather than have to pay for a workers' comp claim for carpal tunnel syndrome or back pain. So it is, a lot of places have that available. Let's see, another one on there is the visual rest breaks. And there's a little trick to remember. It's the 20-20-20. So what you'll do is after 20 minutes of staring at the computer working, you'll look away for 20 seconds and focus on a point 20 feet away from where you're sitting. And then give it a few blinks and start back. So it literally only takes a few seconds and it can save your eye, save you from eye strain. Next slide. Okay. These are some tips on sleep, and we already got some in the last program as well. What I usually introduce to my patients is routine, so going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, making sure your bedroom is nice and comfortable, temperature-wise, your bedding is comfortable. Also, getting into the routine of dimming the lights prior to maybe an hour prior to going to bed, dimming the sound. And the last one on the bottom there is no TV or electronics once you're in the bed. I don't know that I agree with this, but I definitely share it with my patients. Works well for me. Next slide. Okay, so now we're on to changing how things are done. First two there are probably the most crucial, which is prioritize. If you only have a little bit of energy during your day, you're certainly going to want to get the items done that are of the utmost importance. If you had a to-do list and five of the items were prioritized, then those would be the ones you wanted to do first. And then the other ones you can kind of regroup at the end of the day and see what you have left. Planning ahead can also be crucial, and that's at the work or in the home environment. So what a lot of times I'll talk with my clients about is, what does it look like in the morning? What does it look like the night before? Are there possibilities of taking your shower the night before so that you don't have to stress about that in the morning? Could you lay your clothes out the night before? Check the weather. Is it going to be cold? Is it warming up? You know, lay out your clothes that are going to be appropriate for the next day so you don't have to change your mind in the morning. Again, I think I mentioned fixing your lunch in advance, any of that kind of stuff. And also look at your commute times. Is it possible that if you left a half an hour later, you would be there a lot quicker because you wouldn't have as much traffic? And you can kind of play around with that and see what the best times are to drive in. Proper body mechanics are very important when you're doing jobs that involve lifting. You don't want to get injured. And most businesses will help provide training for proper body mechanics. And if not, or you don't feel comfortable with that, again, a referral to a physical therapist can be very helpful for that. Another one is working at a moderate pace. So I kind of think about this one as if you were to rev up your car and go from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds, you would have burned up a lot more energy than if you would have just kept at a comfortable pace when pulling out, and thinking, the slow and steady really does win the race. The more stressed you are, the more energy you're going to expend. Alternating easy and difficult tasks. If you've got a list of tasks and you've got them prioritized, pick through them. Pick the difficult one and then give yourself a little break, and that's both physically and cognitively. Another tidbit that I kind of had read was that if you are allowed to do an activity at work in sitting, you can save up to 25% more energy just by sitting for a small task. So that's definitely something to think about. If you have a more physical job where you have to do a lot of lifting or carrying, try and slide the objects rather than having to pick them up and carry them. And then this last one, the use of assisted devices and or appropriate mobility devices is really crucial. I know that it's hard to use an assistive device or mobility device in the first place. You feel like you might be losing some independence. But in the end, it's going to save you a ton of energy and also make you safer. So I have clients who are very comfortable on their cane in a small household distances. But as soon as they get into a big work environment where there's a lot more people running around, there may be smaller corridors or obstacles that they have to go by, having something, say, just a four-wheeled walker with a seat could make all the difference in saving them so much energy for the rest of their day. Let's see. Next slide. So once you're thinking about tasks, try and think about why you're doing the task and if it's even necessary. Where's the best place to do this task? Is there a better time of day to do it? How should you do it? Should maybe you have someone do it with you to get it done easier? Are there steps that can be eliminated? Again, delegating can be an option. And then ask a coworker, is there anything that they do differently that could maybe help you get your job done more efficiently as well? Next, yeah. So now we're almost done. We're here at the changing in your environment. Proper seating, which we've gone over a few times. That's very important. I got it in there every time. But how about rearranging your work area so that you keep all those frequently used items right near you? It takes a lot more energy to have to look up, reach up in a cabinet when you can have it seated closer or maybe lower at by your side. Also, if you have to get up and walk across the room to get another set of paper for your printer, why not just store that extra paper right beside your printer so that you don't have to expend that energy? Use of appropriate lighting is going to definitely decrease eye strain. Avoiding smokes, harmful fumes if you're working outside, and managing your temperature. So because we're in Florida, I'll tell you about – next slide. I'll tell you about heat management strategies. This is much more detail than you need for the work environment, but keep in mind, you could even ask your boss, can we turn the temperature down a little bit? If you're seated somewhere where beside a window that maybe doesn't have proper window dressings or there's no window tint, can you be moved? Can you ask to have window tint be there so that it can keep you cooler? In the morning, if you're taking a hot shower, which you really should be trying to take a lukewarm shower, stick with a cold rinse at the end. And I had another patient recently who would set up an oscillating fan right outside the shower. So while she was sitting in the shower, also saving energy, she would just open up the door at the end, and the oscillating fan would blow right on her and keep her nice and cool while she was getting dried off and getting out to get ready. Ice packs and cooling garments can be used at work. Some of them can be right under your clothing and be very discreet, so that can be useful. And I had another patient just the other day telling me she made it through the last two years of work with just by changing her clothing to cotton, wearing skirts, and she actually grew her hair out a little bit longer so that she could tuck it up on her head like a bun, and that kept her cooler. And her other tip for pre-cooling her body was instead of having a coffee in the morning before work, she had a big old iced coffee that kept her nice and cool. Next slide. Okay, so some other changes. Final thoughts here. There's a lot of assistive technology out there now, and although I might not be the expert, I can usually direct people to where they might obtain some of these items. A glare-free monitor or ergonomic keyboard can help to maintain your posture better and give you better energy. Assistive technology, voice recognition has come a long way, very, very easy to use these days. People can enlarge the text on their computer screens without having to do anything other than go to their accessibility settings on their computer. And then I had a client recently that was having trouble with getting voicemails and then having to take notes on all his voicemails. He's just too tiring for his hand. So we got his voicemails sent to him. They had voice recognition, and they were sent to him in an email form. So he could just print those emails and have them right there. Some other big ones, and we have plenty of people in our practice that do this, is they may work not part-time hours, but maybe only work 3 days at the job and then 2 days at home. We have a really nice gentleman who was able to, he wanted to be a teacher, and he was able to get into a program where he got to do the online program and online classes. So he was able to be home, and if he had a really bad fatigue day, he could work around that. And then, of course, telecommuting can be great. Very popular now. We have a client right now who he meets with his teammates. They use video chat conferencing. And then if he needs to, he might go into the job maybe once every couple weeks. So there's lots of options out there. Got to think outside of the box. And then hopefully this will make you happy, non-fatigued employees.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tracy and Dr. Sullivan. This has been a wonderful presentation, and I know it's been so helpful for me to hear all of these different sorts of tactics. So I think that we are going to take the next about 15 minutes or so to do some questions and answers. Know that we did have many hundreds of people who had registered for tonight's program, so we may not be able to answer all the questions live this evening. If we don't get to your question, we'll do our best to answer it via email, and I'll state my contact information later on in tonight's call. There will be an opportunity for you to submit your questions. We've had a few that have come in already through the chat box, so you can either submit your question in the chat box, or the operator can assist you with putting your line live, and I'll let the operator instruct our callers who are on the phone how to get into queue in order to ask a live question.
And thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to register for a phone question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question's been answered and you'd like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you'd like to ask a chat question, please use the chat feature located at the lower left corner of your screen. One moment, please, for the first question. Okay, and ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a phone question, press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. And we do have a phone question from the line of David. Please proceed with your question.
Yes. I can get the slides.
Actually, the slides are posted on our website, which is nationalmssociety.org/telelearning, TELELEARNING. If you don't have computer access, feel free to also call us at 1-800-344-4867, and we'd be more than happy to mail you a hard copy of the slides.
Okay, so
tonight's presentation. 1-800-344-4867.
4867.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder again, it's 1-4 on your telephone to register for a phone question.
Maybe we can, while we're seeing if things come in on the line, we can maybe take some off of the chat function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a question from Veronica. Veronica says, I have a major problem with spasticity, which causes fatigue for me. Everything is hard because I'm tired. What can I do to get rid of my asbesticity?
Ooh, can I field this one? I'm Tracy, the occupational therapist.
Sure, Tracy, go ahead.
Okay. So I work in a clinic that's MS specific, and we have a wonderful team of physical therapists as well as myself, an OT, and a speech therapist. And spasticity is one of the main treatments that we do, and you're right, it can be very exhausting. So what we typically do is have somebody come in for an evaluation. Usually starts off with a physical therapy evaluation. There are plenty of stretches and exercises that you can do to help reduce the spasticity and some strategies to use. For instance, like bearing weight onto your arm or bearing weight into your legs a certain way that can be taught you in PT. Working with your doctor, your neurologist, you can also think about taking any kind of antispasmatic medication. Maybe you've heard of like baclofen or tazanidine that can be taken. And then also there's different types of medications. For instance, Botox, which is a botulism toxin. Yeah, I think. Not confused on that one. And that can be injected into particular muscle groups where you're having the most spasticity, which can be really helpful. And then, of course, an intrathecal baclofen pump can be placed too. So there's lots of options for you. Get into physical therapy and your neurologist.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Tracy, for answering that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another question on the chat that maybe we can take, and then we'll see if there's another live question?
Yes, we have a question from Sandy for Dr. Sullivan. Sandy would like to know how much amantadine is a typical daily dose.
Oh, wow. Okay. Unfortunately, I'm not a medical doctor, so neuropsychology is a specialty within psychology, so we get PhDs, not MDs, so I actually can't answer that question, unfortunately.
I have a little information. We also work tightly with a nurse practitioner who was able to make my pharmaceutical slide with me, and she said that a typical dose could be 100 milligrams daily, but that's three times through day, so spread out among your day. And that can change. Like I said, it's not a one-size-fits-all, so it can definitely change time of day and dosage per patient.
Great. Thank you for that. Do we have any live questions on the phone?
Yes, we do have a few phone questions. Our next question is from the line of Dana. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. So my question is, do cognitive issues increase when you go through a relapse, and then can they then improve as you go into remission, or do they just sort of have a steady decline of, you know, cognitive functioning over my lifetime?
That's a really good question, and there's been some research in that area, actually, because they didn't know for sure, and more recently we've seen that people can have cognitive exacerbations. So even without any physical symptoms, there can be an exacerbation of cognitive symptoms that sometimes could be associated with a particular lesion that's flaring at a certain time, and then that resolves and the cognitive symptoms can go away and a person can come completely back to their baseline. However, there will be some people who will not come completely back to their baseline. Maybe they'll be left with a few lingering cognitive difficulties, just like they might be left with some lingering physical symptoms that don't ever go back to baseline. So that can vary just as the physical symptoms do, but definitely there are such things as cognitive exacerbations that can come and go over the course of the disease.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
And our next phone question comes from the line of Karen. Please proceed with your question.
Hello. My question comes mostly from handwriting. I've been trying to take notes during this talk, and lately with my handwriting, I notice it's getting worse and worse. I leave off first letters, I leave off last letters, and even simple words, like I tried to write the word certain, and I kept trying to start it with an S, and I know certain starts with a C, and I had to screw it out three times.
Mm-hmm.
Are there tips on how I can improve that? It's like my brain and my hand aren't connecting as well as they used to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I've heard that complaint from people too. And of course, there's a motor component with writing that can make it more difficult than speaking. So sometimes if it really becomes bothersome, you know, Tracy was talking about assistive devices. There are programs where you can, you could just get a tape recorder and, of course, record yourself, notes to yourself, or use your phone to do that, and or your computer where you have voice-activated software. But if you're really interested in improving your handwriting, then that might be something to work on.
You even mentioned that handwriting helps your memory, and I've noticed if I write it down,
right,
I remember it. So
right,
I want
right
to write because it helps my memory.
Sure, right, right. Then actually, and Tracy, you might be able to address this too, working with an occupational therapist to improve handwriting.
Absolutely. I work with patients on their handwriting skills all the time. And honestly, sometimes it has to do with muscle control, muscle fatigue. Sometimes it has that, it's that connection between your brain and your hand and how you can, you just lose that kind of pathway, that quick pathway. Or it could just be in coordination with your hands where you can't quite grip onto the pencil easily enough. So, honestly, we do an evaluation, and then we figure out exactly what's going on, and then we work on that. Does that make enough sense, give you enough information?
Yeah, and I guess I needed the knowledge that I'm not crazy, but I am not.
No, you're not crazy.
It's more symptoms of the MS. It's not just me losing my mind.
No, not at all. And the spelling difficulties are common, too, actually. Of course, a lot of people will experience that even with just normal aging. But that can be worse with MS, too, sometimes. So you're talking about kind of that lapse between the brain and the hand. You know what you're wanting to write, but it comes out the wrong way. And we can do that in speech, too, sometimes. We know the word we want, and then the wrong word comes out. So it's just, it's that processing in the brain. Those circuits aren't firing quite the right way at that particular moment, and the wrong thing comes out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've noticed that with my speech as well, as you said.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very common.
Thank you so much.